On September 1st, the church down the street from my house began its pumpkin drive. They put a big banner up. Imported Indian gourds for your autumn displays, $5 a pound. Their entire lawn and parking lot were filled to capacity with pumpkins of all sizes. All the little goody-goody Jesus boys sat on the steps of the church and waited for the customers to flood the parking lot, taking 2 pumpkins of each size. By the time the 1st of October had come, there was no visible depreciation in pumpkin levels. The banner was flipped over and now proclaimed, Halloween pumpkins for sale. £4, all proceeds go to charity. No longer content to sit on the church steps, the Jesus boys began hanging out on the sidewalk and suggestively selling the pumpkins to every person who passed by. As it happens, the church lies directly between me and pretty much everywhere I want to go, so no less than 4 times a day, I'd be accosted by a well-intentioned Christian boy pleading with me to buy a pumpkin that I neither needed nor could afford. I needed a pumpkin the way I needed Jesus. A week before Halloween, there were still just as many pumpkins in front of the church as there had been on September 1st. The banner was flipped back to the original side and was painted over in orange and black paint. Halloween special! Pumpkins for Jesus! $3 a pound! Proceeds go to homeless children! I was soon on a first-name basis with the 4 Jesus boys, Jonathan, James, Joshua, and Devin. When I walked by, they no longer asked me if I wanted to buy a pumpkin. They made small talk. The rest of the neighborhood were subjected to tantrums on the street. On November 1st, the church was still packed with pumpkins. The sign had been repainted. $1 pound pumpkins for your Thanksgiving display. All proceeds to benefit homeless children. Jonathan had obviously given up on his friends, who were grabbing onto the pant legs of passerbys, offering to give free blowjobs with a purchase of 3 pumpkins or more. I imagine by the end of the week there'd be a new banner. Jesus commands you to buy his cheap pumpkins, or he will give all of your relatives AIDS. I was close. On my way home from a 2 a.m. grocery store run, the church gates were left unlocked, and a new sign proclaimed, Get these fucking pumpkins off our property, you heathens! Okay, actually it just said, Free pumpkins, but I knew what they meant. So, feeling somewhat bad for the poor Jesus children, I began an early morning project. I dropped my groceries off at the house and began taking as many pumpkins as I could carry and distributing them to the doorsteps of all my neighbors. Soon, every house on the 4 streets surrounding the church had 1 big and 1 small pumpkin on their porch. At around 4, I feared getting caught and returned home. That afternoon, I made another pilgrimage to the store to buy Cherry Coke. James and Devin were sitting on the front steps of the church, laughing and smiling. I waved. On my way home from the grocery store, I saw a poster that said, $200 costume contest tonight. $100 for gentleman in funniest costume. $100 for lady in sexiest costume. On another day, I might have pondered the inherent sexism of this obviously frat boy planned party. Today, I was thinking, to make it fair, shouldn't it be $100 for the gentleman in the most desperate costume? Today, I am the most desperate man at the party. I've got 2 hours before my first hookup since Ethan referred to me as Safey. It's not hard to fall into the familiar routine of shower, shave, tweeze, doubt. It's in the shower that doubt arrives early. I've spent most of my life as a writer hanging around other writers. I enjoy long-winded, well-written, sarcastic blog entries. An email with 6 paragraphs of witty misanthropy can cause me to fall in love. So why am I going to meet someone based on a send me back a pic if interested? I'm interested. Name the time and place. 3 o'clock. Here's my address. See you then. Email exchange. Apparently, my love is a symphony of urbane observations. My lust is nice hair. Let's fuck. I spend a half hour in the too hot shower. The bathroom gets so steamy that I have to kneel in order to see my reflection in the mirror. There's an analogy or a metaphor here that I'm not interested in seeing. I'm embarrassed by the way my hair is thinning in front, the spot of dry skin just northwest of my lip, what feels like it may be the start of a pimple on my butt. I should call this off. I really don't have any hope for love, and given my history with meeting strangers for sex, I don't have any hope for lust. Odds are, the picture was fake. He lied about his age. He's married. He hasn't changed his underwear since the Carter administration. He thinks patchouli is an adequate substitute for personal hygiene. He kisses like the Tasmanian devil. Odds are, I'll leave his house feeling empty. And not empty of sperm, but empty of dignity. I know all this will come to pass. Still, I lather my face with shaving gel and pick up the razor. I do a seek-and-destroy mission on my ass and discover there is nothing remotely pimpular. I'm just about to finish shaving when I nick a place on my neck. I will always have at least one blemish. I toss on jeans and a shirt and call the number he gave me to let him know that I'm on my way over. The phone rings 4 times. I pray for voicemail. I don't want to do this. At some point in the shower, I stop seeing this as an opportunity to get off and started thinking of it as the real ending to a novel. The last hookup. One more real story, not the bullshit Saint and I might live happily ever after. The real ending is me having learned nothing. Putting on my jeans and my fuzzy lucky shirt and walking to some stranger's house with the hopes of sticking my dick in his ass. I get voicemail. His name is Matthew. I leave a message on his machine. Crisis averted. I can go back to sending suggestive emails to a cute boy in Chicago with a self-deprecating wit and the digital camera. The phone rings. Matthew. Pack a bottle of watermelon lube and condoms in my bag and head out the door. Most of the guys on the internet are either deceitful or else they've been victimized by a ruler maker with a cruel sense of humor. 7 inches is often 4.5. I don't ask people for their cock size, not just because I know they'll lie, but because I don't care. What Matthew either lied about or has been conned into believing is that he's 6'1". He's close. He's pretty much my height. I'm 6 feet tall. I don't understand why he's added 2 inches to his height any more than I understand people sending out older fake pics. Obviously, I'm going to find out before you even get your clothes off. We head immediately to his bedroom where we talk. Matthew seems like a nice guy. He's a poet, shoot me now, getting his MFA at a local college. He's occasionally gone to a reading that I host and a reading that I frequent. However, we've never been at either place at the same time. Lovely. I've been rather proud of the fact that I've never let my poet life and my sex life intersect. So when he leans in to kiss me, I pretend not to notice the Selected Poems of Elizabeth Bishop collection sitting on his desk. His kiss. Our kiss. Our kiss is bad. His breath tastes like stale nicotine, but the rest of the problems are not his fault. We are completely out of sync. I am lips when he is tongue. I am tongue while he is lips. He is tongue while I am wishing I was somewhere else. It isn't long before our clothes manage to come off. In a normal relationship, or at least a well-thought-out hookup or one-night stand, you and your partner have some sense of what the other person likes or wants. Matthew's body is not proportionate to what I was looking for. I don't ask him, but I'm fairly certain he isn't all that thrilled with me either. Understand, he's not ugly. Far from it. He's very cute in a nerdy sort of way, and I generally find nerds quite sexy, but his weight is in all the wrong places for me. After a few minutes of awkward kissing and skin on skin, he rolls over and asks me to rim him. Much like the rest of his body, his ass isn't the shape I prefer. But I soldier on, slather some watermelon-flavored lube in the proper area and dive in. And, much like diving too deeply into a pool with too much chlorine, my eyes start burning and I can't breathe. Why? His ass isn't proper rimming shape. There's no position I can find where I can breathe. It could be worse. At least his ass is meticulously clean, as it should always be when meeting for sex. I give up and begin fingering him. His breathing gets heavy, and though I won't realize it until a few minutes later, he comes. He then sits up, covering the wet spot on the bed with his ass, and attacks my mouth with second-hand tar. He also begins licking my ear. I figure he must enjoy having his ear licked, so I decide to sacrifice my tongue to save my ear. I breathe heavily into his ear while doing some more licking, and then, just as he's getting into it, I can't do it anymore. It's just too absurd. As soon as I stop, he pushes me back on the bed and begins snapping his finger around my nipples. Not sexy. I move his hand down towards my cock. While our arms were moving, my hand brushes his chest, and this is when I realize he's already come. I'm not even on the same continent with coming. He proceeds to go down on me, I think. I stop paying attention at this point. I'm trying to remember whether or not I locked the door on my way out of the house.
Want a 69?
Not really, but since I'm here, sure, why not? I begin nearly gagging on his cock. I don't think it's big. I haven't really noticed it one way or the other. While I try various ways to get him off using my mouth and hand, he is... What the hell is he doing? Is he still blowing me? I can't feel a fucking thing.
I want you to come on my chest.
Yeah, and I want a meaningful relationship with someone gorgeous who cares about me and maybe a pony made of rainbows. There are some things you have to be patient for. And he is patient. In the time it takes me to come, he comes again. This time, I see it with my own eyes, and it does nothing for me. I kneel there, impassionately jerking my cock for what seems like months. If our roles were reversed, I probably would have gone out for pizza while he was jerking off. I would have gone out for pizza in Italy. While he towels off, I put on my clothes and jacket, stuff my lube and unused condoms back in the bag, and head home. I'm barely out of his house when I notice a woman in a burqa walking towards me. Most days, a woman in a burqa would set off my inner activist. I think how wrong it was for a woman to be forced to cover herself, but today, all I can think of was how comfortable she looks, how warm, how safe. If she'd just come from robbing a bank or fucking a stranger, no one would be able to pick her out of a police lineup. Me? I am walking the streets in tight pants, and my fly is open.
Your fly is open, McFly. The crowd is open, I think I know why. I'm back from the future, seeing it with my own eyes. And yep, I'm still the future of the shy. Back in college, I had to get my back up off the futon. I knew that I couldn't cop a coupe with no coupons. Look at that neutron on his green like two times. People asking him, do you have any great
coming from the south, 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 south.
You just finished listening to the final portion of All My Exes Live in Sex Flicks, which is also the final portion of The Loop, Part 7, Empty Full, which was brought to you by Watermelon Flavored Lube and the Unitarian Universalist Church, believing equally in the teachings of Jesus and the Great Pumpkin since the dawn of time. Intro music for this episode was the Vince Guaraldi Trio with the Great Pumpkin Waltz from the Peanuts special about, you guessed it, the Great Pumpkin. The incidental music did not exist. If you happen to hear incidental music during the course of this podcast, you might be having some sort of aneurysm. Please consult a physician. The outro music is Common featuring Kanye West with Southside. For more information about how to order All My Exes Live in Sex Flicks, or if you just want to check out the written version of this story or others, you can check out www.crookedtreehouse.com. And usually I tell you, if you have any questions, you can email me at insafemode@gmail.com. But today, after this musical credit thing ends, it's going to be a little different. I'm going to be doing a reader's guide to All My Exes Live in Sex Flicks. So, if you have any answers, please feel free to email me at insafemode@gmail.com. greatpumpkin.com. If you still have questions, please consult the Great Pumpkin. He knows all. He sees all. Because you have carved a face into him that mirrors your own.
Our Chicago show. Please stay tuned.
And now, a listener's guide to all my exes live in sex flicks. 1. What are the themes of this book? 2. In The F Word, Stone mentions Melissa Etheridge and a toaster. Do people still understand Ellen references? 3. Why did In Safe Mode hide his pornography in a Where's Waldo book when his room was so littered with all those Magic Eye collections? 4. In Hanging Out in Public, Stone is at a golf course. Could he possibly get whiter? 5. If the game of kleptomania scavenger hunt bingo seems like a harsh way of enacting revenge on someone who merely stole the occasional CD or jacket, how would you have made the bastard suffer? 6. Yao Wen Handsome seems like a horribly contrived name. Make a list of 50 even less convincing combinations of Chinese first names and American synonyms for sexy. You still haven't come anywhere near the hilarity of the actual name of the person Yao Wen is based on. 7. True or false? Breaking Up is Not as Hard to Do as Pop Music Would Lead You to Believe is actually just a retelling of Neil Sedaka's popular 50s song. But Stone has replaced the word darlin' with drag queen and comma comma come do be do down down with crumbling trundle. 8. For further reading on essays and essays, please check out Gene Beretta's Dear Dear, in particular the chapter on Shotokan and Shotokan. 9. In Rancid, what is the significance of them drinking Sousa tequila instead of Jose Cuervo like normal high school students? Do these characters think they're better than us? 11. Is it just me or is there a lot of gay sex in this podcast? 12. In Leah Hager Cohen's Train Go Sorry, Cohen explores the deaf community in a slightly different form than Stone does here. How much cooler is Stone's take? 13. Stone's mother would like you to know that the constant shifting between menial retail and restaurant jobs worries her, too. Do you think Stone will ever get his act together and get a real job? He asked, as he recorded this from the comic book store he worked at. Whew, it's gonna be okay. 14. How overwrought is In Safe Mode's description of how cold it is in Wisconsin? I mean, come on, dude! 15. Do you think Adam secretly knew the password to the safe house before he arrived in Milwaukee, or is he just the luckiest stepbrother fucker on this planet? 16. The individual CDs that make up U2's Remix for Propaganda series are all named for fruit. Given what we know about the protagonist of this supposed memoir-based podcast, is Bono a big old queer, or does he just need a lot of vitamin C? 17. The phrase, running is not a sport, it's a survival technique, is not Stone's original aphorism. This was stolen from the bassist for J-Bob, who once said it while being chased by a hockey jock with a hand covered in Vicks VapoRub. Is this plagiarism, or is Stone the new Andy Warhol? 18. The original name for the section, Part 2, The Golden Age of Sodomy, was Part 2, Elvis Rex. But Stone didn't want to give away the importance Elvis would have on the narrative. Instead, he wrote the title of the chapter on an icon of young Elvis's famous hairline. Discuss. 18. Provincetown is really gay. 19. The original version of awkward pauses between breath contained no attributions to the conversation. Stone ended up changing it not just because everyone who read it or heard it found it confusing, but also because he's tired of John Grisham showing up at his job demanding credit for his innovative style of printing screenplays in fiction formatting. 20. Can't there just be one story by a gay writer that doesn't reference Catholic priests being child molesters? It's such a downer. It's so 1998. Oh, that part was about 1998. I get it now. At least the character didn't end up killing himself. 21. An allusion is when a writer references someone else's art. The most frequent piece of fiction alluded to is the Bible. Given the near infinite amount of possibilities the Bible offers for allusion, why do you think Stone chose to go with VH1's Behind the Music? 22. As he mentions in Float On, Stone switches tenses during the Ryan section of the podcast because, quote, I can't write about him in past tense because he keeps happening every time I think his name. The tenses continue to flip throughout the rest of the collection. What do you think that means? 23. The Dark Crystal, Jellyfish, and Sperm is either a really hilarious band name or a terrible experimental film. It's an even worse appetizer. 24. Do you think the sunburned author that Adam trysted with ever got famous? If so, what are the odds Adam could get a book deal out of it? 25. America Online? What is this, 19... Oh, right, we covered this already. 26. Though he no longer speaks with her, the part about sleeping with a guy named Ryan Duda was read once on stage in Cambridge by an infamous lesbian writer from Boston. Stone was the least comfortable person in the room. 26. Have you ever had a significant other move into your family's house and still been under the impression that your parents didn't know you were banging all the time? Did your parents do a poor job raising you because they're too stupid to realize you're gay? Or did they do a poor job raising you because you're too dumb to realize they're not stupid enough to believe anything you say? 20. All of the titles of the loop section of this podcast were written in recursive. Discuss. Apart from the Hummer, name another sex act named after a car model, or vice versa. Drowning pedophilia is easily the most literary reference in the book. Would Shakespeare approve? Would Bacon? Would Shakespeare ever eat bacon? Did Bacon ever Shakespeare's? Did Adam steal these jokes from a late 70s episode of The Muppet Show? Breath of Fire was a Capcom role-playing game popular during the summer of 1998. Sadly, the relationship that begins in that chapter is better suited for Mortal Kombat. Am I right? How would you explain Elvis's pet Gila monster to your mother at 3 a.m.? Using a permanent marker and a piece of 68-inch by 88-inch piece of paper, draw a diagram of the variations on Elvis's backstory. Is he, in fact, the Joker? How in-depth can a listener's guide for glorified pornography be? A grandfather clause is a situation in which an old rule continues to apply to some existing situations, while a new rule will apply to all future situations. Frequently, the exemption is limited. It may extend for a set period of time, or it may be lost under certain circumstances. Do you think the whole episode titled The Grandfather Clause was Stone's way of explaining the temporary nature of his relationship with Elvis, or was he just making a terrible pun? David and Saint are the two most reoccurring characters in the podcast. Yet the author is never really in a relationship with either of them. What does this say about In Safe Mode's goals and self-esteem? Is The Loop, as a place, a chapter title, and concept, just a little over the top to you? Also, I'm pretty sure fukavahicophobia isn't a real word. From paperboy, to record store manager, to waiter, to theater tech, to fudge cutter at a Renaissance fair, be honest. If you were his mother, wouldn't you be nervous too? I just noticed this listener's guide is longer than some of the other episodes of this podcast. Troubling. Is the sheer kimono a metaphor for the U.S. government's complicity in the 9/11 attacks? If so, how do all the David Bowie references fit in? Is Stone saying the U.S. and Al-Qaeda's relationship is like a labyrinth? Cribbage is the 9th or 10th game referenced in this podcast. Yet, not a single story has mentioned strip poker, or the weird truth or dare cards that Kevin Harris made, that Stone's parents found in his room and interrogated him about. Surely, that would have been an interesting story. How come he didn't tell us about that? Miniature dachshunds are huge pains in the ass. Great Danes only cause minor damage. All of Adam's important papers, his social security card, his birth certificate, and old newspaper clippings were hidden in a fake Edgar Allan Poe book. It was one of the books that disappeared when Melissa had her, well, it wasn't a break so much as her psychotic constant. A few months later, he found she had sold the books to a used bookstore. The faux Poe was not amongst them. Does this mean that pre-Melissa Adam is a different person than post-Melissa Adam? Mortimer Velociraptor once had his picture taken peeing on the Lincoln Memorial. He was wearing a diaper at the time. Discuss the political implications. Fish, geckos, hamster wheels. Is Adam saying he views men as pets? Why Elizabeth Bishop? Is this a veiled reference to one art? No more questions, please. Move along. This podcast episode is over. There'll be more. Just wait, sir, ma'am, close your laptop. Turn off your iTunes. I'm going to need to see your ID because I need to. That is all you need. Ma'am, don't you raise your voice to me or I'll be forced to tase you, ma'am. Fine, you asked for it.